everybody. I'm Sabrina. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to introduce tonight's main speaker, Kip C. from Vista.
Good evening. My name's Kip Collins, and I am an alcoholic. Ain't she a peach? That's my darling. My sobriety date's May 12th, 1984. My home group is Robber's Roost. It's a men's meeting. It meets on Thursday nights at 6:30. I want to thank Mike for asking me to come up here. I hate to come up to Los Angeles, but this is what you call willing to go to any lengths. You know, I live in the country, and I like it that way. My father is Sioux and Irish, and my mother's Irish and Cherokee. And when my daddy drank, my mama liked to fight. And, basically the way it was, just in a general way, you know, we'd be waiting for the old man to come home. The later it got, the more apprehensive it got, you know, and after a while you'd hear that truck coming up the road and you'd look out the window, and if you looked at all the neighbors' houses, you'd see everybody turning off their lights and getting their lawn chairs and coming outside, you know, because it was getting ready to happen. There's a lot of action around my place, man. My mom and dad were passionate, you know. It was fire and ice all the time. I do not blame my alcoholism on my father. If anything in the world, my dad taught me exactly what alcohol will do to a man. He taught me what it'll do to a family, what it'll do to children, what it'll do to a marriage. I can't put it on him, man. He was a prime example of what not to do. And I blame my alcoholism on the San Diego Unified School District. They had this great idea about 1964 that it was time to start educating the young people about drugs and that other stuff that we don't talk about in AA. And so we went to this room, and they showed us these movies, and they had these people come up and talk, and they told us what this stuff did to you. And when that was over with, my mouth was watering, you know. And I asked my buddy Balto, I said, hey, can you get any of this stuff? And he says, yeah. And he says, meet me after school tomorrow. So I met him after school. I said, you get it? He goes, yeah. I said, well, what do we do? He says, well, we got to stop, and we got to rip off some wine. I said, what for? He said, well, I don't know, but my old man drinks cheap wine with this stuff. And, you know, I knew about willing to go to any lengths a long time ago. So we went in this little market, you know, we each boosted a short dog of sweet red port, went down this canyon, and the magic began, you know. One of the first speakers I ever heard was a guy named Serenity Sam from Venice. And he made a statement at a meeting that I knew it was okay for me to be here. Because he talked about something that I knew exactly what he was talking about. You know, I lived in a neighborhood. It was all Hispanic. First generation, hardly anybody spoke English. My family, my cousins, are all very dark skinned. They have brown eyes, brown hair. I had very white skin, white hair, blue eyes. And we went outside. The Mexicans wanted to beat our ass. We went in the house. The Indian wanted to beat our ass. You know, and I thought my name was Pinche Güero, you know, until I was about 12 years old, you know. But Serenity Sammy says, you know, he says, when I was born, he says, I fell out of my mother's womb and I hit a cold concrete floor. And I was crawling across hostile territory towards my grave. And then I discovered alcohol. And I knew what he was talking about. Because when I put that alcohol and that dope in my body for the very first time in my life, man, that's what was missing. Because everything had been just black and white, and all of a sudden there was color in the world. I've been feeling less than and scared to death of this world, absolutely terrified of this world. And that fear went away. All that stuff went away. And it was magic. And I knew about these first three steps, you know. I knew that I was powerless over this world. And it scared me to death, and I knew my life was unmanageable. It was absolute mess at 12 years old. I smoked this dope and drank this wine, and I came to believe there was a power greater than myself, and I immediately, with no reservation, turned my will and life over to it. And I never, ever looked back. You know, alcohol worked for me. It worked for me right from the gate. I didn't get sick and throw up. Man, I don't know, alcohol did something to me that nothing in this world has ever done for me. It made me feel like a whole human being. My wife says my story is colorful. I don't know. You know, I was at a meeting with my sponsor very early, and they had this lady up, and she was talking, and she was a real, real rich lady, and she was talking about she was having a bridge party, and she had had too many martinis. She knocked over her martini cart, and she was so humiliated, she turned herself into AA, and everything had been wonderful ever since. And I'm looking at her, and I looked at my sponsor, and he patted me on the shoulder. He says, "Kip, it's all right." He says, "You don't have to lose everything in the world. You don't have to go to prison. You know, you don't have to get here with half your parts missing. But for some of us, it helped, you know, and that's my story. It took a lot of pain to beat me down. You know, I got kicked out of school in the very beginning of the eighth grade for hitting a teacher. It was the second time I've done it, and the guy was a jerk, you know. I'd probably still do the same thing today. But my mom found my stash, and she was pissed off. And in a moment of anger, she told me to get the hell out of her house. You know, I'd been waiting for someone to tell me to leave for a long time. And when she said go, I was gone. Before she turned around, I was gone, man. And she gave me a ticket. And I went over to Carlsbad. I was talking to a friend of mine. I'd never been anywhere. I'd never done anything. I was 14 years old. And my buddy says, "Hey, check this out." He says, "All these people, they're going up to San Francisco. And all they do is listen to music and get high and make love, you know. And I like music, so, you know." I went up to the Haight-Ashbury district, and I got there in 1964, and I learned a whole new way to live. We were listening to Jefferson Airplane on the way up here, and I can remember when they were playing for free in Golden Gate Park. They hadn't even cut a record yet. Most of you guys probably don't know who they are, you know. There's some of you out there that do. And my father had always told me that if I wanted stuff in this world, I got to work hard, I got to do this, I got to do that. You know, and I found out at a very early age, and it ain't nothing I'm proud of. I found out if I had the bag, I could have anybody or anything I wanted. And that's the way I conducted my life for many, many, many years. I never did make a real good hippie. I'll fight at the drop of a hat, you know. Someone says something, I'm ready to get it on, you know, and I'm basically just a capitalist, you know, and I started seeing all types of opportunities, and everybody wanted this, and I went to Mexico and started an importing business, and at the age of 16 years old, I got caught with 200 kilos in Mexico, and I was sentenced to about 25 years in prison at La Mesa Federal Penitentiary. And I'll tell you right here and right now, nice things don't happen to young white guys with long blonde hair and blue eyes. And if anything in the world, that should have talked me into saying, you know what, the way you're living, you ought to be changing it. But you see, I've always had money, and I had money. I've always been a talker. And I ended up, thank God Mexico is a civilized country, you know. You can bribe people, you know. And I found the right people to do things with, you know, and I got $5,000 to them. And I made some connections inside that jail that lasted me for the next 20 years. It was actually one of the greatest moves I'd ever made, you know. But I got out of there, you know, and I thought, you know, maybe I ought to get it together. And then I got back across the border, and I go, nah, you know. And I went on, you know. I got busted again on my 18th birthday, and I was charged with 27 felonies. And I was living with this young gal, and she was pregnant, and we were real excited about having this baby. And they came in and got me, and I was gone. And I never got a letter from her, and I never got a visit. And she never called. I never called. No, the phone was shut off. And nobody called me. I never had a visit. And after I got done with that term, I got out, and I went to go look for this lady and my child. And nobody would tell me where she was. I couldn't find her. The family wanted nothing to do with me, man. They told me her brother said they'd shoot me if I even came around again. You know, and I went around for years with this big hole in my gut because of this child. You know, when I was a kid, what I wanted more than anything in this world, I wanted a family. I wanted to have children. I wanted to have a wife. I wanted to have the house and the little white picket fence. I didn't know how to do it. I wanted all that stuff I saw on television, you know. I wanted it real bad. I just didn't know how to do it. I got out of there, and I ran into this little girl, and she was 15 years old, came from a wealthy family, and she bailed me out of jail 3 times in 1 week. Man, the last time she did it, she woke up a judge at 3 o'clock in the morning to make bail for me, and I made a vow right there that I would never let this woman out of my sight again, you know. I don't know too much about love, but I sure know about jail. You know, there's not a lot of opportunities in there, and it's hard to make a buck. And I got out of there and I married that little gal, man. She was 15 years old and just as innocent as could be. And I took that gal for a ride and her ears are still ringing. She's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to say today. And, one day she came and said, we got to go to the hospital. I said, for what? And she goes, I'm going to have a baby. She had mentioned that she was going to have a baby. She was pregnant a few months before that. It didn't really dawn on me. I hadn't really thought about it, you know, and I'd been real busy. And she said, we're going to have the baby today. And we went to the hospital, and they came out, and they put this little boy in my arms. And that was the second most magic moment of my life. And they put that little boy in my arms, and I looked at him. And for the very first time in my life, I fell head over heels in love with another human being. I looked at him and I made promises of what kind of father I was going to be and the things that we were going to do. I promised to love him and protect him all the days of his life. And I meant it with every fiber in my being. And a couple years later, we went to the hospital again and she gave me a little girl in my arms. And exactly the same thing happened. I fell head over heels in love with this little girl. And I promised her I'd protect her, and I started planning her wedding. You know, she was still wet when they gave her to me. And I'm the kind of alcoholic, I can be sitting in an AA meeting, and some pretty gal will walk in. Before that meeting's over, we've gotten married, had a couple of kids. She cheated on me. I hate her, you know. Call her a bitch in the parking lot, you know. And I've never met her, but things happen quick in here, you know. Sound like there's some other people like that in here, huh? Hey, it's free. You know, and for the next 5 years, I was an ideal father. And I had a lot of money. I'd made a lot of money, and I had a real nice place. And all my time was spent with my kids. I played with my kids. You know, and about every 6 months, I'd go do a scam, and I'd come back, and I'd play with my kids, and that's what I did. And on September 6, 1976, something happened that day that changed my life forever. I was watching my son. My son was completely deaf. He was born that way. And you had to watch David all the time. You couldn't let him out of your sight. Me and him were playing, and I got loaded. And it was real hot that day, and I was real thirsty, and no one else was around. I didn't think about it. I just got on my bike, and I went up to the street to go get a six-pack, and I came back down. When I come back down the hill, the paramedics were at my house, and the police and the highway patrol and the fire department and all the neighbors, and I didn't figure out what was going on, and I waded down through that crowd, and my son had chased me out of the driveway, and he had been run over by a truck. And I walked through that crowd, and I saw my little boy. And his head was split open, and I could see his brains, and bones were protruding all over his body. And a little piece of me died. You know, I spent the next 9 months in a hospital, in intensive care with him in a coma. And every day, the doctors would tell me to pray that he dies, because he has so much brain damage, he'd be a vegetable. And it was at this time I started crying out to some God. I didn't know anything about God, but I started begging this God that I didn't know anything about to please give me my son back. I'll do anything in this world if you give me my son back. And my son lived, but he never mentally got beyond the age of about 4 years old. And he couldn't hear and he couldn't talk. And he had a lot of psychological problems and a lot of physical problems throughout the rest of his life. You know, at the same time this was going on, I have a brother, Bill. And everything that I've told you that I've done, I can tell you that my brother Bill was right there with me. He was like my shadow. He was the best friend I've ever had. We were only 11 months apart, and we backed each other's play, right or wrong, under any circumstances, under against any odds, no matter where we were. And we did everything we did. We did it together. We were a team. And my brother came down with a disease called schizophrenia. And my family had him committed to a hospital. And they called me. He called me from that hospital after he had been there for a while, and he says, "Hey, get me out of here, man." I said, "Are you okay?" He says, "Yeah, they're giving me this medicine now, and I'm all right." I said, "All right, brother." And I called my mom, and I talked her into letting me have conservatorship. I got a lawyer. I got him out of that hospital, and I bought a mobile home and put it on a piece of property next to mine. And me and my brother continued doing what we were doing. And my brother started getting sick. He started getting sicker and sicker, and all of a sudden, I had to go to the Midwest to do a little thing, and I told my brother, I said, "Hey, I got to go," and he said, "Don't go, man." I said, "What are you talking about? I got to go." He says, "Something's wrong." He says, "I'm coming apart." And I said, "I got to go. You know I got to go." And he's begging me. I had to pull his arms off of me, and I threw a handful of money in his hand, and I said, "Look, I'll be back in 3 days. Me and you'll take care of this. It's always been me and you, and it always will be, man. Just hang tight. I'll be back in 3 days." And I got back to Oklahoma City, and the scam I was doing went sideways, and I ended up, I was gone for 3 weeks. When I came back looking for my brother, I walked in that place, and nobody had seen him. And I went up to that mobile home, and I opened the door, and my brother's head rolled out. And the third day I left, he'd taken that money and bought a gun and blown his head off. And there was just a big pile of maggots laying in that doorway. And another big piece of me died, you know. Two people I loved the most in this world that I'd taken responsibility for. I blew it, man, and I just destroyed both of them. And something broke inside of me that day that was never, ever to be repaired until I completely surrendered to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only reason I tell you this story is to drive a point home. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it states very clearly that there are those among us who got here with grave emotional and mental disorders. And I'm one of those people. I'm one of those people. And I'll tell you this from my heart to yours, that I thank God alcohol does for me what it does for me. If alcohol didn't do for me what it does for me, I would not be your speaker here tonight. I would have joined my brother. Because the pain, the guilt, and those pictures in my mind were so vivid. But alcohol took it away. Alcohol took all those feelings of guilt away. It took those images out of my head. Put a smile on my lips and a song in my heart, and I could just walk through anything in this world as long as I had a little liquor in me. They talk a lot about bottoms in AA. I don't know anything about it. You know, I've been in this field for a long time, and I see a lot of people hit bottom. Usually we bury them the next day, you know. I have my ex-mother-in-law. She hit a bottom. She spent the last 11 years of her life in a hospital with Kerckhoff syndrome, and that's a wet brain. She didn't know who she was. She never got any worse, so she hit bottom. I had a young man who had 90 days and got mad at his wife not too long ago and locked himself in a van and he drank a quart of vodka straight down and he died. He hit bottom. He ain't never going to get no worse. But it's been my experience, as long as you can think and have anything at all, any thought process at all going on between your ears, it never stops getting bottom. Anytime you think this is it, I guarantee you will find a basement. The one most wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is, like my wife told you, you can pick a bottom. You can pick one. You don't have to go no farther. It's not necessary anymore. You know, my wife made a career move at about that time. My son was in a special hospital, and she left my coke connection, which was a real good move. He had a lot more going on than I did. And it was just me and my little girl there. My little daughter, she was just terrified because she'd had this ideal life. We had this beautiful home. She'd had her brother she adored. She had her uncle she adored, her mom and her dad, you know, and everyone was gone or dead. And her father was absolutely insane, and he couldn't stop drinking. She was scared to death. And this guy came over to my house and he brought this bottle of stuff called Mad Dog 2020. They have that up here? Stuff's never seen a grape, man, I'll tell you. But I drank that stuff, and this lady said, "Sir, you have to get off the airplane." And I went, "What?" I was sitting in my living room, the last thing I remembered, you know. And I opened my eyes, and I'm on this big wide-body jet, you know, and it's empty, and it's just me and my little girl sitting there. I said, "Where am I?" She goes, "You're in Fort Lauderdale." I said, "I hate Fort Lauderdale." She goes, "I don't know anything about that. You got to get off the plane." And so we're getting off the plane, and I'm trying to be real cool, trying to get my daughter, maybe she knows what's going on, you know. And I did what any of you guys would have done. You know, I got off the plane. I went to a payphone. I called a cab. Cab came. I got on. I said, "I need to go to a hotel and stop at a liquor store on the way because I need to figure out what's happened here." And I come to in this room, and I'm completely tied down. You know, I feel like someone's beat me with clubs. Found out later they had. And I don't know where my daughter is. I don't have any recollection of what's happened. And I found out later that I met this couple at this hotel. We started drinking, and I went absolutely nuts. You know, and they were going to lock me up, but they said the guy's just nuts, and they put me in a nut house. And I got out of there, and this family had taken my daughter, thank God. And I said, "Come on, baby, we got to get out of Florida. I told you, this place is bad luck." You know, and I'll tell you that for the next 3 years, it never got any better than that. Everywhere we went, that's the same story. I mean, there's 1,000 stories just like that one. It never got any different. But every place I went to, I promised her it was going to be different. I promised her. I said, "Baby, I love you. We're going to get it together. We're going to get you in school. We're going to get a house. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to protect you." And I meant it. I meant it with everything I had. And the last place was back in Oklahoma, you know, and I come walking in that house. We'd finally got a tiny little house. And I got her enrolled at school for the first time in 2 years. And I came home and I was drunk and I'd gotten in a fight with a guy and I got blood all over my clothes and it wasn't mine. And I told her, I said, "We got to get out of here." She was 7 years old. But she just looked at me and she looked at me with this look I'll never forget. She just picked up her doll and her pillow and she went and stood by the door. And I changed clothes and we got on a cab and we went to the bus station and I got me a bottle of wine and drank it and got on that bus and I passed out. And I come to in Gallup, New Mexico, and I woke up sicker than a dog, and I opened my eyes and my little girl was sitting there and she was rocking back and forth and she was crying, and I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "Daddy, I am so hungry. You haven't fed me yet." And I said, "Okay, baby, as soon as we stop, I'll get you something to eat." We pulled into Gallup and I got off that bus and I went and got me a bottle of wine and I went and bought her a little sandwich, and I got up to go pay for it, and I stuck my hand in my pocket, and I only had enough money for one thing or the other, and I had to put her sandwich back. And I've done a lot of things in this world that I don't share from the podium. But I've never done anything in my life that haunted me more than that moment. And again, thank God that alcohol works, you know. We got back to California. I went over to my mom's house and thanked God for my mom. She took my daughter and told me to hit the bricks, you know, and she took my little girl. And for the next three years, I was a wino. I lived in the bushes. I lived on the side of the road. I panhandled for wine. I drank until you locked me up, until I hurt myself. I was in a hospital, until I did something stupid and you put me in the nut house. And the minute you released me, I started drinking again. Because alcohol worked. I could not live without alcohol. There's no way in the world I could live without alcohol. And I've been to these A&A meetings, you know, in a lot of different institutions and jails I've been in. The hospital institutional committee would come in and they would start talking this stuff, and I would very patiently try to explain to them that I wasn't an alcoholic. I was a drug addict. I just couldn't afford any drugs right now, you know. And they said, "Well, if you ever find yourself drinking when you don't want to drink, come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we'll welcome you with open arms." And I just kind of filed that away, you know, a little ace. Just, you know, someone will take me in. Oh, okay. You know, and I was in front of this 7-Eleven panhandling for wine. I was sicker than a dog. Scared to death I was going to go into convulsion. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about fear in meetings. I'll tell you my idea of fear. Fear is you stand in front of a 7-Eleven. You're physically addicted to alcohol. I don't know if any of you know what that means, but when you're physically addicted to alcohol, you can't stop drinking. And when you stop drinking, you're going to go into convulsions. You're going to go into DTs. You're probably going to go into a grand mal seizure. And what's going to happen, the ambulance is going to come. They're going to put you in there. They're going to take you to a place and detox you. And you can't drink when they do that. And you have to come back out and you have to start the process all over again. And the thought of doing that is just a lot of work, you know. And I'm getting ready to go. It's like 5:45 in the morning. They're going to open up the cooler at 6 o'clock. I got 65 cents in my hand. Wine cost 87 cents. And no one's given up another penny. And I'm scared to death, man. I'm starting to shake real bad. All of a sudden, it's 6 o'clock, and this guy pulled up. And it was like, he said, "Hey, Kip, how are you?" And I looked at him, and it was a guy that I'd known when I was a kid. And I couldn't stand people like him. He came from a nice family. You know, he always had nice clothes. He got good grades. Everybody liked him. He lived in the good part of town. You know, and he just looked at me and he smiled and he gave me $2 first thing in the morning. And man, I don't know if there's any winos out here, but you believe in God after that. You know? I mean, $2 is a whole quart of wine, and that's going to keep me well till about 3 o'clock, you know, and I got a little change left over. And I went in there and I got me a quart of tawny port, and I'm walking out of there shuffling out. And I look in that window and I see this family looking at me in their car, and I know they're judging me. You know, he's got this square little wife and these square little kids, and he's wearing this square suit and this short hair and clean shaven and a square four-door sedan, and I couldn't imagine living like that. But I just shuffled off to my bush, and the weirdest thing happened. Because I opened that bottle and I go, "La puerta," you know, the doorway, "here we go." And I had this thought that maybe I ought to go to A&A. Now, where the hell did that come from? I found out me and that guy got to be real good friends later on. And I'm not here to talk about religion. I don't believe it has any business in Alcoholics Anonymous. But that was a real good Christian family. And as that drunk shuffled off, they got out of their car and they prayed for that poor drunk to God to intervene in his life. About the time they were praying for me, I had this thought, maybe I ought to be going to A&A. You know, and I got into this meeting. I don't know how. This is told to me. Most of it's hearsay, this rest of this. But I do remember this. I got to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and I walked in, came in the back door, and I looked at all these people, and they were all clean cut and smiling and laughing. And I looked around, and I sat down next to this young gal, and she scooted all the way across the room. You know, my hair came down to about here, and my beard came down past my belt. I've been living in these clothes for almost 3 years, and a lot of things lived on me besides me. And I sat down, and people are kind of looking around, and I'm looking at them, and they're looking at me, and I'm going, I wonder if they have a room for the more severe cases. You know, don't look like drunks to me. And then I started listening, and they were talking about God. And I'm like, Sabrina, man, that's the last thing I want to hear about God. And then I saw you pass a basket, and I knew you were going to start singing any minute. You know, I'm getting ready to get my hat. I'm getting the hell out of here, man. And all of a sudden, this little gal, she'd been looking at me since I walked in the room. And she kept trying to smile at me. Every time she'd catch my eye, she's smiling at me. And I thought she was one of them wet-brained drunk women you hear about. And she's kind of nuts. And I got ready to leave, and I started to stand up, and she shot to her feet. And this is what she said. She said, "I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous 27 years ago." She goes, "I came in the back door. I stuck my head in, and I looked at all you ladies. And you guys were ladies. And I looked at you men, and you were all clean cut." And she goes, "I turned around to leave because I knew once you saw what I was that you would turn your back on me." She goes, "I've been a prostitute since I was 14 years old. I've done everything a woman ever had to do out on the streets to survive." And I just couldn't stop drinking. And they told me you could help. And I looked at these people and I knew it wouldn't work for me. But I turned to leave and someone grabbed me by the arm and brought me into the room and got me a cup of coffee. And they told me this. They said, please don't go nowhere. We need you. She proceeded to talk about the next 27 years of her sobriety. She talked about the 12 steps. She talked about her sponsors. She talked about the traditions. She talked about her home group. She talked about her commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. She shared some of the joys and some of the sorrows she had walked through in sobriety. And she walked up in front of all those people that didn't want nothing to do with me, and she put her arms around me and she kissed me right on the mouth. The bravest woman I've ever known in my life. You know? And she said this to me. She says, honey, she says, don't go nowhere, baby. We need you desperately. Now, I have never shed a tear in my life. You can't beat one out of me. But something started happening. That gal, she wouldn't let go of me. She just kept holding on. And all of a sudden, this thing started right in my gut, and it was just a sob, and I started crying. And I was embarrassed. And I couldn't stop. Nobody had ever done that to me before. Nobody had ever told me they needed me desperately, except someone that was sick and needed some dope, you know. But she needed me. She didn't even know me. And I fell in love with what this woman had. And I said, I'm going to go to this A&A. And I started coming here, and right off the bat, every one of you lied to me, you know, because you told me that if I quit drinking alcohol, my life would get better. Now, I have no idea what alcohol does for you people, you know. But alcohol is not my problem. It never has been my problem. It never will be my problem. I have an acute allergic reaction to sobriety, you know. You know, in about 3 days, everything's so damn real, you know. All those feelings and all this stuff and all those other stuff starts coming up. I start remembering and that guilt starts and I can't sleep, you know. I can't fall asleep. I haven't slept without alcohol in many, many years. And I'd stay sober for as long as I possibly could. You know, you told me to get a sponsor. I said, what's a sponsor? They explained to it. I said, yeah, I've been on parole half my life. I'm not about to volunteer one of these lops. You know, and they looked at those steps, and I said, what's this? And he pointed out, I said, I'm not powerless. Just having a bad break here, you know. And you know, I've been seeing a psychiatrist since I was 12 years old on and off, so what are they going to restore me to? I've never been really considered sane. You know, saw that God stuff, drove right by that, didn't want nothing to do with that one, you know. And then I saw that fourth step. I said, what the hell is that? And he goes, well, you got to sit down. You got to make a list of everything you've ever done, and you got to admit it to another human being. I fell out of my chair laughing. Yeah. I come from the streets, and I learned a long time ago, man, you don't cop to nothing, even if they got pictures, you know. Deny everything. Demand a jury trial. Hope for the best, you know. Don't ever share a weakness with another human being. They'll use it against you. Only thing you tell people is what they want to hear so you can get your hand in their pocket, you know. And that stuff was, I just went, whoa. You know, I listened to you people share. I'd be so embarrassed. And then I saw that other one. It says, I said, what's that? He goes, well, you got to, anyone you've wronged, you got to make it right. I went, yeah. I thought of some people, you know, and I went, gee, I'm sober now. I'm sorry that I kicked your door in and stole 10 kilos of cocaine and beat you and your wife up. <You know>? That might be fine for you people that live in the suburbs, this shit, but you know, the... I started thinking, I went, man, you people are out of your mind. I wanted what you had so desperately that if it would have been a tangible thing, I would have knocked one of you in the head and taken it. You know, I know how to get shit that way. And I kept coming here, and I kept coming here, and I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 years straight. Nonstop. I came drunk or sober. I have passed out in meetings. I've thrown up in your meetings. I've pissed on your floors. I've stolen your money. I was doing active 12-step work long before I got sober, man. I came to Christmas morning, 1983, butt naked, handcuffed in the rubber room. My face is stuck to that mat with the blood because the cops have beat me so bad they broke both my cheekbones. And I'm ripping my face off this floor, and I look up in the window, and I see these cops looking down at me laughing, you know, and you just know Santa Claus ain't coming, you know? But you know you got your money's worth. And they let me out of there. Man, those people knew me so well, you know. They just said, we'll see you later, Kip. Merry Christmas, you know. And I shuffled off, and I ain't going to come back to this A&E. I'm that person in Chapter 5, man. People like me don't get sober. That might be okay for those people, but not people like me, you know. They keep telling me to do things like get an ID and my real name. They keep telling me to do things like get a job, you know, and all this other stuff that has nothing to do with my problem. You know, and no one wants to hear about my problem. They keep wanting to tell me, just keep coming back. Just go to meetings. Just go to meetings. Get involved in service. Get a sponsor. Do the steps. And it didn't work for me. Of course, I didn't want to do any of that stuff. I like to go to speaker meetings. You know, I like to get to speaker meetings, sit in the back and learn the lingo. You know, easy does it. One day at a time. You know? Have a nice day. How you feeling? Oh, great. You know? Everything's just wonderful, you know. Isn't sobriety wonderful, you know? And I'd sit with you people as long as I could until it'd be midnight, and then it would be me, because you wouldn't be here. And I'd go absolutely stark raving sober. And if there's anyone in this room tonight that thinks you're going to be able to stay sober on other people's sobriety, you can do that for a little while, but not for long. I made a conscious decision that morning that I wasn't going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to go do what I do. I drink. That's what I do. I'm going to drink till I die. I ain't afraid of dying. You know, I should have died years ago. And I went, and I'd been working a little bit. I had a little place to live, and I got as much liquor as I could possibly carry. And I walked inside my little place, and I started drinking. And I started drinking, and I drank, and I drank. And on January 6th, I hit a spot that was the absolute most terrifying, the loneliest, the most terrifying moment of my life. Because alcohol stopped working on January 6th. I remember that day crystal clear. It didn't take away the pain no more. It didn't take away the guilt. It didn't take away those feelings. It amplified it. And the thought of living one more day without alcohol was working for me. It was the most terrifying thought I've ever had. And when you've been to AA for 6 years and AA don't work for you, and when alcohol stops working for you, let me tell you, you will know loneliness such as few people can even imagine. You come to the jumping off spot and you wish for the end. I know what that means. But at that time, when I realized alcohol wasn't going to work no more for me, I pulled out my piece, put it up to my heart and pulled the trigger. And I blew my left lung and two ribs out and knocked me all the way across the room. And I'm sliding down this wall with blood flying everywhere. And the only thought I got is, thank God this nightmare is over with. Thank God. Just let me out of this thing. And I come to in this hospital. You thought I died, didn't you? No? There was this guy, man. I hated this son of a bitch. His name was Charlie Tuck. I'll break his anonymity because he's dead. You know, and I hated him, man, because he came up to me in a meeting one time and he got dead in my face. This guy had been sober so long, he said they only had one A in AA when he got here. You know? He came up to me and he got dead in my face and he looked at me and he says, you think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid? And I looked him right in the eye, gave him my best jailhouse look. I said, I'm tough enough, old man. Don't you ever doubt that. He looked at me and he smiled. He said, you ain't tough. He said, you're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. He said, that might make you dangerous, but it don't make you tough. And he walked away laughing at me, you know. Well, I tell you what, from then on, every time I'd go to a meeting, I'd look in that back window to see if he was in there. If he was in there, I wasn't going in, you know. And here I come to in this damn hospital. I'm coming out of this coma, and I can hear, this guy had a deep, deep, gravelly voice. And I hear this voice, and I open my eyes, and there he's standing there with these two newcomers with his eyes about this big, and he's got that big, ugly blue book. And I'm going, my God, I died, gone to hell, and AA's here, and Charlie's in charge of it, you know. And he's going to start preaching that A&A, you know. So I just keep my eyes shut. I ain't going to give it up, you know. And, Charlie don't say one word to me, man. He puts his arm around these two newcomers, and he says, fellas, you see this pitiful man here? And they go, yeah. And they go, this is what happens to an alcoholic who doesn't take the steps. Come on, let's go. Yeah. He didn't know how sensitive I was, you know. And, I'd like to add that those two gentlemen are still sober today. And like I said, I was doing active 12-step work long before I got sober. I got out of that hospital, man, I ain't going to come back here, man. You know, I'm just going to go drink. That's what I do. I keep hoping it'll work because it's insane in my head. I'm stark raving sober 24-7. You know, I can't stop the screaming in my head. I keep drinking drugs, anything I can get in my body, you know, and it ain't working. And on May 12th, I come to the same way I always come to. I got to get something in my body before the screaming starts. I know it's not going to work, but I got nothing left. What are you going to do? I'm going to keep trying. And the thought I had that morning was weird. I've been to so many of these A&A meetings, y'all have poisoned my mind. Because you told me this. You said the ABCs read at the end of every chapter 5 at every AA meeting. And said that I'm powerless over alcohol. I thought, I know I'm an alcoholic, man. You know, I'm classified by the state of California. I got a card that says I'm a chronic alcoholic. You know, I have no problem with that. But it says in there, chapter 3, about my innermost self in here where I live. Don't matter what I admit to you or what someone else calls me. It's in here with me. And I have to understand what alcoholism, exactly the way it affects me. And I started thinking about it, and all of a sudden I had that vision of that morning on that bus with my little girl. My little girl who I give my life for. But you see, this is the way alcohol affects me. When I put alcohol on my body from that moment on, it doesn't matter about who I love. It doesn't matter about any of my plans, any of my dreams, any of my morals, and it sure as hell doesn't matter about any of yours. I have to do whatever alcohol tells me to do, and alcohol tells me who I can hang with. It tells me where I can live. It tells me what I got to get up. It tells me when I got to go to bed. It tells me everything I got to do of where I can go. It runs my life from the minute my eyes open until they close at night. And it starts all over the very next day. And I understood exactly what finally, in my innermost self, what alcohol does. And then I got to that next spot that no human power was going to fix me. I kept hoping one of you gals were going to fix me. You know, some of you tried. And if you're here tonight, I'd like to make amends. You know? Come on, you were willing. And I got to that last part I wanted nothing to do, man, that God stuff. That God stuff, man. I just get so embarrassed, man. I wouldn't even want to hold your hands. You start talking about the Lord's Prayer and talking about all this stuff. I had to leave many meetings when it got just too godly for me, you know. But I started thinking about the people who had what I wanted. And it wasn't their women. It wasn't their money. It wasn't their stuff, man. It was a look in their eye and the way they walked through this world one day at a time without taking a drink. They walked through life with dignity, with a smile on their lips and a song in their heart. And all of one of these people talked about the same thing. They talked about this power that did for them what they couldn't do for themselves. I got down on my knees that morning and I said this little prayer. And it ain't changed much from now to then. And it went like this. I said, I don't know who you are. And I don't think that makes any difference. But I will do whatever you put in front of me if I don't have to drink today. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. And I absolutely, totally surrendered with every fiber of my being to a power I didn't even believe in. And I went and got that old man, Charlie Tuck. And I asked Charlie if he would sponsor me. And he said this. He says, are you done? And I said, I pray to God I'm done. He says, what are you willing to do? I said, whatever you tell me. He says, Kip, he says, I've been watching you for a long time. And people like you don't get sober. You don't get sober in AA. Something inside of you is badly broken. And I don't know what it is. That's between you and God. But for some reason or another, God has given you a window. And I advise you to step through. And this is the way it's going to have to be for you one day at a time the rest of your life. And that is that nothing, no woman, no job, no child, nothing in this world can ever be more important than you doing the things you have to do to maintain your sobriety. And that's a hell of a lot more than just going to meetings. He said, if you're willing to do that, I'm willing to sponsor you. And I said, yes, sir, I am. He said, we took me outside, and it was on Mother's Day. And we got down on my knees in this park. I didn't want to get down on my knees because all these families were there. I was embarrassed. And he thought, looked at me and he said, you're embarrassed. He said, these people have been stepping over you for the last 3 years. You know, you're on your knees. You're halfway to your feet, boy. You know, and I got down on my knees, and that old man taught me how to pray. And then what he did with this, he advised me to get involved in a step study meeting, a book study, and a men's meeting for me to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day of the week. He told me to get a job. He told me to get an identification in my real name, which was just terrifying, you know. He told me to get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night there and get there early and shake hands with every single person that walked in the door. He told me to get a phone list and call three alcoholics every single day and not the same three. He told me to get to a meeting and always stand outside and look for the guy that's standing there all alone. Looks like he had to walk here and we rode the bus, and stick your hand out to him and welcome him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he got me involved in service, and he got me involved in service to an extent where I had a commitment 5 nights a week. And he took me through those 12 steps very thoroughly in the first year, you know, and he got me actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you that something happened in this guy's life. At that time, the state of California was in the process of making me a ward of the state. I was 36 years old, and it became quite evident to everybody that I could no longer manage my life, and I was a threat to myself and others. And they were going to give me a card that I get to carry, and any time I screw up, they're going to put me back in Patton State Hospital. And I like hospitals. If you've ever been to prison or been to a hospital, hospitals are better. You know, they care. You know, and you say, I'm feeling a little tense today, and they'll give you something, you know. And it was sounding good, you know. And I had to go before a board at 6 months sober. And I had to take a battery of tests, and they released me. They said that this isn't the same human being we've been treating. And things happened in my life that cannot happen. I have an hour pitch, and I'm going to have to wind up the rest of it real quick. So don't anybody move. I'll have to start all over. I met her in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, a lovely woman, got sober the same day I did. And we got married. Between us, we had 6 children and a desire to stop drinking. And that's it. and through my sponsor's guidance, through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship, things happened in my life that are absolutely impossible. I've never had a job in my life. I smuggle dope, man. You know, I can put 9 tons of dope from Zihuatanejo to Boston, Massachusetts with no problem, but I have never filled out a job application. You know, I don't know the first thing about writing a check or doing anything else. I was a stranger in a strange world when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a lot more than just not drinking. I never been a citizen in my life. I walked in here, and they had me doing all this stuff, and he told me to get a job, and I got a job, and I found out that I was really good at it, you know, and I became a contractor, and I made a lot of money. At 3 years sober, the state of California gave me my driver's license back, which was supposed to have never happened. I got my contractor's license that year. I signed a job with a big skyscraper downtown San Diego with more money than I'd ever made in my life. And the same day, I got a phone call, and that little girl, she called me up and she said, are you Kip? And I said, yeah. And she goes, do you know so-and-so? And I said, a long time ago. She goes, that's my mama and you're my daddy. And I've been looking for you. And I want to meet you. And I want you to meet your grandchildren. And this was a gal that was born when I was in prison. She was 23 years old. And she came and she brought me 3 beautiful little grandchildren, you know. And I had a home and I had a good life to bring her to. And I got to meet her mom and I got to make amends to her mom and tell her that she made the right decision, that I'm glad that she left and I didn't have to drag them through the life that I went through. I got my daughter back. I got my son back. He came in and we got involved in Special Olympics and I watched him graduate from high school at the age of 23 and they said it was absolutely impossible. Me and him built a boat together and we did all those things I dreamed about doing when he was born. That little girl, a man came and asked me for her hand in marriage, and I was able to give her a marriage, a wedding, that exactly the way I dreamed about the day she was born. I still pay for it, you know. Probably always will. You know, but I walked her down the aisle, and I watched her look at me exactly the way I dreamed about her looking at me. And you see, you people gave me all that. I threw that away. You gave it all back to me. Everything that I threw away, you gave me back in spades. And at 10 years sober, I had everything imaginable. I had the house. I had the boat. I had just made an ungodly amount of money. I went to Australia for 2 months and went to AA all over. And I came back, and I was a member of a church. My family's all Pentecostal evangelists, so I joined the Catholic Church in sobriety. Give them something to talk about. I got involved in my faith, and I was involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fulfilled every function there is to do in Alcoholics Anonymous except for delegate. I came back and I was just looking at my life and I'm going, how do you get from that bamboo bush to here? It's absolutely impossible. And I'm reading in the paper and I find out where this man has broken into this girl's house and raped her and cut her to pieces. And I looked down the name and it was my daughter. And I'll tell you this, that I'm perfectly capable of first degree murder. If you touch anything I care about. And I went to that hospital to go see my daughter, and she didn't look human. This man had taken a knife to her, and she cut her face to pieces in her throat, and she lost the use of her left arm and her breast, and everything was just cut to pieces. And what happened was, man, you see, I don't know about anger. I know about making plans. I know about it getting real ice cold inside here where I live, and I don't talk to nobody, and I get real quiet. But I plan on getting away with it, you know, and I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it to anybody. And I'm nuts, absolutely insane. And my sponsor told me that all the answers were in the book, and I'm reading this book, and I'm looking for a loophole is what I'm looking for, you know. And I'm reading in there, and it says this. It says that we cannot afford the luxury, dubious luxury that other people can. We cannot live in anger. We can't live in resentment because it'll cut us off from the sunlight of the spirit and the insanity will turn and we'll drink again. It doesn't say unless someone rapes your daughter. It just says that. It says if I'm an alcoholic that I cannot live in that resentment and anger because it'll kill me. And my sponsor told me from the gate that nothing could be more important than me being sober. Nothing could be more important than me doing the things that I have to do to maintain my sobriety. And I have to read in that book because I can't get rid of this resentment. And I get down and I find that if I got a resentment I can't get away from, that I got to pray for this person every single day to have everything out of life I want. Hardest thing I've ever done in my whole life was get on my knees and pray for that man. And I'm not going to stand up here and lie to you and tell you I forgive him. I work on that still to this day, but the insanity went away. The insanity, that ice water in my veins went away. And I was able to go take care of my daughter, to be a father. I was able to take care of my grandchildren, to be a grandfather. And I didn't have to drink. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked real good. Next thing, they told me that I had cancer and they're having to cut my lips off. You know, I like my lips, you know, right where they're at, you know. And I just talked to this doctor, and he wants to do this radical surgery, and he's telling me, man, this is getting, you know, I'm telling him, listen, I'm getting a lot of emotional pain with what's going on. I'm an alcoholic, man, and you can't put anything in my body that cuts me off. Anything that affects me from the neck up, you can't put in me. And they went, well, I don't think you can do this. And I ended up going to several different doctors till I finally found a doctor that would do it, and we did a surgery on my lip, and they cut about half my lip off down here and did plastic surgery, and I did it with Novocaine and aspirin. And I'm not recommending that to anybody, you know. And I'm not here to tell you that I'm a tough guy, because I ain't. Man, I whined and sniveled for about a month, you know. But there's nothing in this world. I know that if I put something in my body when I have emotional pain going on, that there's no way I'll ever be able to stop. And nothing's more important than me being clean and sober. The next thing, something had been going on with my wife, man, and I had a lovely wife. She was a great woman, and she was the very first woman I had ever really let into my life. I had known a lot of women, but I'd never been intimate with one. I'd never shared myself, and I learned how to do that in AA. And she came into my life, and she was my best friend, but something had been going on with her. I didn't know what it was, and I came home, and I said, Connie, what's going on? And she said, we got to talk, and we sat down, and she told me, she goes, Kip, she goes, I can't live this lie no more. I love you very much. She goes, but I can't live this lie anymore. I'll drink. And I said, what are you talking about? She goes, Kip, she goes, I'm a lesbian, and I'm in love with Chrissy, and I can't do this no more. I don't want to hurt you, but I can't do this no more. And I didn't think she was going to say that. You know? I thought of maybe my sock's not picking it up or something, you know. And, you know, I reacted the way any 9-year-old would, you know. I got mad, angry, screaming, calling her very vulgar names, attacking her character, her integrity. I didn't hit her. And I ran to my godfather in the church, who happened to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 28 years, his name just happened to be Father Bill Wilson. And I went to see him, and I'm telling him, he's a Catholic priest. He's going to be on my side, you know? And I'm running it down to him, man. I'm running it down, telling him what's going on and how I have been wronged. And look, he's just looking at me going, my. I said, so what do you think, Father? What do you think I should do? He says, well, obviously, you owe her an amends. I go, maybe you weren't listening, you know? And he goes, no. He says, no, I heard you. You sound exactly like that guy on page 61 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, you know, the guy that thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he only managed well. That everything he did, he was always kind and generous. Or maybe he wasn't, but whatever he did had a hook in it, you know? Whatever he did, it was about him. Because you keep telling me about, oh, you were so wonderful to her, you were so wonderful to her children, and you did this and did this, and now she's done this. He goes, who in the hell made you God? He says, since when are you in charge of anyone's sexuality? You know, I'm your confessor. You have enough problem with your own. You know? He says, you owe her an amends. Just because you're married to her, that doesn't mean you own her. And you know what it took for her to come and tell you this? You think about it. And so I did. He says, you need to go write about this and you need to go make an amends. And I went and I followed directions in Alcoholics Anonymous and I went and wrote about it. And I went and wrote about that marriage and I did an inventory on it. And my wife had been a good wife and she kept her vows to me until she couldn't. And when she couldn't, she came and told me. And we got a very amicable divorce. You know, and she kept my last name and she, to this day, we're still very dear friends. I didn't know you could do that, you know. I didn't, you know, when a woman kicks you, you just kick him to the curb and go next, you know. Oh, like you women don't, huh? Yeah, right. You look so innocent, honey. You know, I got attacked by this damn dog, almost lost my arm, and the same thing. I was in a hospital, I couldn't work. I lost everything, man. I lost everything I'd worked for in 10 years. I lost my business, lost everything. The last thing I had was my son. And it was just me and him. And in May, he got real sick, and I had to take him to the hospital. And he was 24 years old. And I sat with him in the hospital till October, and October 4th, he died in my arms. And I did not know that you could hurt that much. You know, I did not know it was humanly possible to hurt that much. But if it was at this time that it says in the promises, it says we will know serenity. And I knew serenity. And I'll tell you about serenity with me. And serenity has nothing to do with a pocket full of money, watching a beautiful sunset with her. Serenity is watching everything that you've worked for and watching the people that you love leave or die. Watching your life completely come apart and crying and hurting, but at the same time in your heart of hearts knowing that this is God's business and God don't make mistakes. I mean, knowing that. Not a little no, capital K-N-O-W. And I had to tell him to turn the life support machine off my son, and I held him until the last convulsions were over with. And I got down on my knees that day, and after I'd shaved him and got him ready for the coroner, and I thanked God at the most sincere moment of my life, that I thanked the God of my understanding that brought you people to me. Because, you see, you enabled me to have the 10 years to be the kind of father I always dreamed about being. To have the relationship with my son that I dreamed about having. And I had that relationship with me. He loved me with all of his heart, and I loved him. And I sat with him, and the day before he died, I come walking into his room, and the nurse said, your son wants to talk to you real, real bad. And I walked in, and he told me in sign language, he says, Daddy, he says, you don't have to worry about me no more. And I said, what's the matter? What do you mean? He goes, God came and talked to me last night, and he told me he's going to take care of me from now on. And he was at peace with himself, and he went into a coma that night, and he died the next morning. And I was at peace with it, you know. You know, I 10 years sober, everything that I'd worked for and everything that I'd loved was gone, and it was just me and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started a brand new life. And What I did, I'd only been to the eighth grade. I went to school. I got an education. I went into a profession that I'd always wanted to go into. And I wanted to jam a woman into my life real quick, you know. And I told my sponsor, I said, I'm very lonely. I need a relationship. He says, you're not lonely. You're horny. There's a big difference, you know. And he said, I want to explain something to you, that no alcoholic can ever have a relationship as long as they need one, you know. When you don't need a relationship, you can have one. When you're comfortable. I tell you this, you new people, I don't know a lie. I know the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as outlined in the first 164 pages, will work for absolutely anybody, anywhere, under any circumstances. It don't matter where you've been. It don't matter what you've done or what you ain't done. If you're willing to live by these principles, things will happen in your life you will not believe. You will never have to run from anything again, chemically or geographically. It'll teach you how to live in this world one day at a time, very comfortably, no matter what happens. You know. I know this too. I know that no matter what I got to do to stay sober, it sure as hell is easier to stay sober than to get sober. You know. I'll leave you with this one thing. My sponsor gave me one more promise. It wasn't in the book. And he told me this. He says, if you will live by these principles, there'll become a time when someday, when about midnight, when there ain't no one to oppress, just you, when you're going to walk by a mirror and you're going to see the guy looking back that you always wanted to be when you were that 9-year-old kid. And I ain't going to tell you I'm any big deal, you know, because I ain't. But I'll tell you this, as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts of Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, an excellent sponsor in the work that I have done, and a loving God, I am the best human being I've ever been in my life, in every aspect of it. You know, and I owe that to you. And I want to thank you all for letting me come here and your hospitality, and that's it.